again, until we fix these things that we know that continue to bring us up short, we'll come up short. Our players are playing extremely hard. They're giving us a chance to be in games and win games. We just got to do it better.
There's another game where we fought really hard and came just a little bit short. Like I said before, they hurt really bad. And, you know, I want it so bad for these guys in the locker room. I'm giving them everything I have every time because I want it for them so bad, and they deserve it, as do the rest of the guys on the team.
Stafford takes the shotgun snap, looking left, though. He's got the golden take. Take cuts it up 15. Take outside 10. Take to the 5. Take to the end zone. Touchdown, Detroit Lions. Anquan Boldin with a big block to help spring him. And the Lions are an extra point away from tying this game. Keenum back, throws over the middle. It is picked off by the Lions. Intercepted by Raphael Brooks. Put this game away.
Guys made big plays in big moments. Did a nice job putting the ball in the end zone against a really talented group. You know, I don't think any situation is too tough for us. Seemed to rise to the occasion and play really well. It was a good, hard-fought football game. That's the NFL. Comes down to the fourth quarter more often than doesn't. You know, you got to make the plays to win it. We were able to do that.
Snap to Barrett. Barrett throwing right corner of the end zone. And that ball's caught by Noah Brown for a score. Noah Brown with a touchdown in the right corner of the end zone as he got behind cornerback Derek Tindall. And the first TD pass of the night for the Buckeyes give them the lead here in overtime. Fourth and goal, Badgers of the Buckeye 4. Hornibrook in the shotgun, gets the snap, back to throw. Looking, the left-hander pumps, and he's going to be sacked and dropped right at about the 16. Nick Bosa, Sam Hubbard, and others with a game-ending sack in overtime. And Ohio State, who trailed this game by 10, comes from behind to defeat Wisconsin 30-23. 20 consecutive true road victories for the Buckeyes, who remain undefeated in a whale of a game here in Madison.
What pleases me is the brotherhood of trust. It's real. If it wasn't real, we would have lost. The indicators are up. The red flags are up. The team is good. We're playing. The environment, we'll take it and go.
Swung and grounded towards short in the hole. Backhanded by Lindor. Jump throw to first on one hop. And a stretch and a tag made on the bag by Napoli with that back foot. And the kid Frankie Lindor is starting to show America what everybody in Cleveland already knows. There's not a better all-around shortstop in the game. Santana swinging. Sends a liner deep left field. This ball is gone! He just did clear the 19-foot wall in left field. An absolute laser shot by Carlos Santana. Led the American League in steals. First time he's ever led the league. At age 35, no less. There he goes. Pitches outside. Martin throw to second. No chance. Head first slide, and Davis made it easily. Way outside. Off the glove of Martin Davis going to third. Throw to third. In with a feet first slide. There's that aggressive base running. Lindor, line drive, base hit to center field. And man's back on top, 2-1. I wouldn't even have to call this pitch. The crowd will tell you. Here it comes. Guess what happened, folks? Back foot slider got him swinging. How about Andrew Miller? 5 strikeouts in 2 shutout innings of relief work. Swung on line to center field. Back goes Davis. Turns one way. Now the other. Makes the catch. Right in front of the track. Ball game. And the Indians have won again.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
It is exactly that on this Monday afternoon edition, an extravaganza of epic proportions on the way. Thanks so much for joining us right here. We have got an unbelievable program for you, and it's got to start. It's got to start with kudos to the undefeated in the 2016 postseason, 5-0 against two of the mightiest offenses in all of baseball, without two of their best 3 starting pitchers, to the Cleveland Indians. We ask that. Yes, indeed. Give them credit. Tigers fans even have to be appreciative of this because
that's how winning is done.
Exactly correct. Mr. Scream is here. He's excited for what's going on. I can't see how you cannot be. Mrs. Scream, good to have you aboard as well. How about the way this American League postseason is going thus far? An incredible American League Championship Series with the Cleveland Indians just 2 wins away from their first World Series since 1997. Jim Cushlin, how old were you in 1997?
In 1997, I would have been 16.
16 years old, a sophomore in high school, the whole world before your eyes, wondering what's going on. Unbelievable, like a lifetime.
Junior year, actually, for me on that. And yes, it was. It does feel like a lifetime ago.
I mean, seriously, not, you know, this is an unbelievable 19 years since they were there. And they're not there yet, and they'd be quick to tell you they are not there yet. But this is something to behold. We're going to talk a little bit about the ALCS and about last night's unbelievably dominant performance by Clayton Kershaw in game number one, as the Dodgers are kind of the little engine that could, and even though it's impossible to call a team with a $300 million payroll a little engine that could, but they're just not supposed to be here. They weren't supposed to get out of the American League Division Series against the Nationals. They were the underdog there. They really aren't supposed to take down the 103-win Chicago Cubs, but there they are behind Kershaw, putting together a tremendous postseason thus far to try to put to bed all of the critics, myself included, of his career-long performance in the postseason thus far. The game's best pitcher in the regular season for the last several years, but had struggled in the postseason, now turning in a tremendous performance as his team takes a 1-0 lead over the Cubs. So baseball, 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 getting in the way of what we normally would be calling a Monday afternoon quarterback edition of the Extravaganza right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. Kush, I don't know if you got it, but let's hit it.
Grab your helmet. You're going in. It's time to play Monday afternoon quarterback on 106.5 The Ticket.
Yeah, we really like to spend our Monday afternoons, excuse me, I think I hurt my voice again, Kush. I do this about once a show now. By doing something silly, whether it's a scream or holding that note like I did last week, Friday, I guess it was, that I really shouldn't have. But at any rate, really like to spend our Mondays dissecting everything that happened in the weekend that was in terms of football. Great college football on Saturday. How about prime time? The Ohio State Buckeyes in Camp Randall in Wisconsin taking on the 8th-ranked Badgers. Some people felt like the Badgers might have been a little bit overrated with that 8th ranking. Not the nation's most prolific offense, to say the least. But, yeah, they live on their defense. They kind of ride that. And, my goodness, they rode that to a near upset of the number 2-ranked Buckeyes. It took overtime for the Buckeyes to take down Wisconsin and their freshman quarterback 30-23. Primetime football at its finest. So that was really, really exciting. Also on our Monday afternoon quarterback, we would be talking about the I-75 rivalry renewed. And once again, for the 7th straight time, the Toledo Rockets take the measure of their arch rivals at Bowling Green, 42-35 in the Glass Bowl. Obviously an offensive showcase. By my count, that's 77 points put up on the board, Cushlin. And it was a much, much closer game I think Toledo wanted, and that I think maybe a lot of us, and I'll put my hand in the air, guilty.
Me too.
We talked about this last week when we promoted the game, whenever we had you had Coach Candle on and you had Coach Jinx on, and we talked about the I-75 rivalry.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you know, maybe not as competitive as a game as we've had in previous years between these two clubs, because, quite frankly, the Rockets had just been rolling teams.
Yeah.
Even in their one loss, put up 53 points at BYU, and BG was one win. You know, going into that game, they were 1-5. So I just kind of figured this is going to be a pretty easy Rockets victory. Guess what? It wasn't.
Yeah.
The Falcons gave them more than what they wanted, Jim.
And essentially, there's a textbook example for all you youngins out there of what happens in rivalry games.
Did
because
you just drop a youngins
yes,
on
I did.
Is this hee-haw?
Yes, I did. Because here's another thing. And this is why I was, you know, in some picks that I made last Friday, subbing for Mike on Drive Time. I said there's no chance that Bowling Green's going to win this game because Toledo's just so strong. Did you know the spread for that game, Bob, going in was Toledo by 31?
31. No, I thought it was 20. I knew it'd be more than 20.
It got up to 31, at least as of Friday afternoon. It was 31. So to end with a 7-point game like that, there you go. Textbook example of what happens in rivalry games.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, it's an old cliche, and sometimes we don't like to use cliches, but sometimes they just work when they say throw out the records in a rivalry game. Because anything can happen, and obviously they really, really can. And BG put up a great fight. Still a very miserable season for the Falcons, you know, and we feel bad for them sitting here at 1-7 in Coach Jinx's first season. By the way, did you see Speaking of BG and Coach Jinx, did you see the former Falcons coach, Dino Babers, post-game celebration in Syracuse's win?
I'm trying to forget that one.
You're trying to forget that?
Yes.
Why is that, Jim Cushley?
Let's see, because once again, the Carrier Dome is a bad place, apparently, for my Hokies to play in.
Did you see the celebration?
Yes. Yeah, I did. And you know, on one level, I was happy for him because, you know, we had a chance when he was here, coach of Bowling Green, to talk to Dino Babers. One of my favorite interviews we've had over the course of this show. He's just, he's such a fun guy. But yeah, there was a part of me that was hurting real bad seeing that one.
I got to tell you, I mean, I understand that's your alma mater, but I got to tell you, this was their first win over a ranked team in... Oh, goodness gracious. How long was it?
It's been a long time for Syracuse. I forgot the exact year.
Now I lost the stat, but what I do know is that they beat number 17, Virginia Tech. It was 31-17, and it was their first win over a ranked team in a long time. And to say that Coach Babers was proud of his guys for holding the fort in their own building is an understatement. Give this a listen. Let's see if we can make this happen here. Dino Babers talking to his club post-game. After beating Virginia Tech here, give this a listen real quick here. He's asking his team, did you see what they were saying on social media?
I ain't gonna see no social media. Now listen, now. Okay? Now listen. Yeah. People don't know what we went through. They don't know about the kumbaya meetings we had this week. They have no idea. They don't. We are together.
Yes, sir.
We play as one. We win as one.
Sure.
Off the field, on the field, picnics to the classroom, we're together.
Yes, sir.
They thought they were going to come in here and just have an easy game.
Yeah.
Cut out on me now. We're not done. We didn't get to whose house it is. I didn't catch whose house this was. Coach, give us. Oh, we got some. I got to tell you, the audio cannot even do justice to the video of what they were doing in that locker room at Syracuse. Now, listen, I have never, Cushlin, you know this, I have never had any reason to be a Syracuse fan. I'm still not a Syracuse fan. I've never rooted for them for a day in my life. I've never rooted against them either. They're just a club, a school, in New York that I just don't really give too many thoughts about. It is what it is. But I got to tell you, that fired me up, and because of the local connection, since he was, of course, the coach of Bowling Green last year in the last couple of years, and he really lifted the Bowling Green program in a big, big way. Now he is at Syracuse. He got a bigger job, a better job, an opportunity for him to rise in the coaching ranks. Don't think that he's going to be staying for very long at Syracuse. He is doing some great things there, even though he's had some big losses. He gave up some, this is his first year. These aren't even his players yet, obviously. He did give up 62 to Louisville. He did give up, or his team did, give up 45 to South Florida and 50 to Notre Dame. But they just beat Virginia Tech, number 17 in the country, 31-17. It's their third win of the season, and they are growing and building on something there that I just find very, very exciting. And again, maybe it's just because I really enjoyed my interviews with him over the course of the last, couple of seasons that he was the coach at Bowling Green before he left. And I just really got to appreciate the kind of person he is. But I love what he's doing there at Syracuse. That, what that scene looked like in that locker room in the Carrier Dome was really, really amazing. And if you saw it maybe in a highlight over the weekend, you know what I'm talking about. If you didn't, hopefully that gave you at least some small picture of what it seemed like. But I'm just very happy for the guy, Jim.
Yeah, and it's definitely easy to be happy for him. He is such a good guy, as what you're saying. We learned over the last couple of years having chances to talk to him, and
I just like great motivators.
Yeah,
I like great motivators.
He's got
coaches.
That. He's got that.
And
good call.
That's what he is. I mean, I the post game, you know, it's like it's not their fault. It's not their fault. They didn't know. They didn't know. They didn't know whose house they were coming into. They didn't know what we had done and what we've been working toward here. And I like coaches who can inspire young men. And that is a very inspirational, motivational kind of coach. Not all motivators are the same. They're not all that loud. They're not all that spontaneous. They're not all that flashy.
Yeah.
They're not all that boisterous. But some of them are. And it just depends on their style and depends on
sure.
who they are. And that's his style and that's who they are.
Yep.
And I absolutely loved every second of that. No disrespect to your Hokies. And I know that one kind of hurts for you as an alum. But, man, that's just a great thing to see.
No, it is a great thing to see. And perfectly honest, I got nothing usually against Syracuse. They're also in the opposite ACC division as my Hokies. So I'm only against Syracuse on days like Saturday when they play against each other. And even then, I was, steaming a little bit about that, but it's cool to see. It was cool to see. It's, we had chances to talk to him and everything, got to know him a little bit. He's not just the random Syracuse
and
coach, at least for me anymore.
And I would be, even if I didn't have those opportunities to kind of just get to appreciate the kind of person he is through those conversations, I just, if that would have been, I don't know, East Tennessee State's coach, I get fired up by those kind of things. There come points in time when you get old and you still wish you could play. And then you think about all the work that goes into it, and you think, nah, I don't think I could play.
Right.
Then you hear that, and it makes you think, give me a helmet. I can do
give me
this.
A helmet. I want to go in.
I got a few more plays in me, and I want to go play for that guy. It's just one of those things, and that's why it's going to work, by the way, big time for Syracuse. In the same way that it worked for BG when he was at Bowling Green, he's going to recruit like a mother. He is going to bring a lot of great, great young talent in because there are going to be a lot of people who really respect and appreciate the kind of guy that that Dino Babers is.
So well said. Anyway,
that's a little bit off the beaten trail there. I just was thinking about Toledo and BG, and BG took me to Dino Babers, and that would be an insult. I just called him Bieber.
Yeah.
Ooh, sorry, Coach. No, I got mad respect for you. None for Justin Bieber. All right, so it was Battle of I-75 that went the Rockets' way. As we know, Kareem Hunt punched it in from 3 yards out, 18 seconds left, 42-35, sellout crowd at the Glass Bowl. And really just a tremendous win for the Rockets, even though it was a lot closer than they or anybody else really expected it would be. How about Logan Woodside, by the way, still impressing people, working his way into midseason quarterback award conversations nationwide, 23 of 33, 22, 4 touchdowns more. Just doing some terrific things there for BG, or for UT, I should say, as they took down BG. All right. Now, we heard some stuff, other stuff in the audio, in the opening montage, other audio clips, for our football, or our Monday afternoon football conversation. Two very, very different circumstances going on, two very divergent paths being taken by the Detroit Lions and the Cleveland Browns, the two teams that we focus the most on, of course, right here in Toledo, Ohio. How about Matthew Stafford and the kind quietly excellent season? Can I say that about Matthew Stafford?
I think you can.
Together? I mean, it's a 3-3 football team. I don't want to overstate this and say, well, this is a team that's, shocking the world and is a favorite to win the division, because clearly they're not, and they're not favored to win the NFC. But quietly, especially after a 3-game losing streak, they've won 2 in a row, close games both, Philadelphia and Los Angeles. But, what he is doing and the kind of season he's putting together deserves some accolades, deserves some respect.
Sure. Especially considering the Lions have no running game really to speak of due to injuries.
Yep, that's very true. I mean, he's not Matt Ryan. He's not putting up those kind of crazy numbers. He's not You know, Dak Prescott, even, who's just blowing people away. And that's a great story we need to talk about, by the way. The Cowboys rookie. You know, he's not Tom Brady coming in, you know, after his suspension with a vengeance and doing the things he's doing, but he is playing the quarterback position, you know, I don't want to say as well as anybody else, but pretty doggone close. Pretty doggone close. I mean, I give Matthew Stafford a great deal of credit. 23 of 31, four touchdowns, not a single pick, 139.8, his quarterback rating for the game, his QBR 87.1. It really is a, you know, it's really a testament to what he's been able to do post Calvin Johnson.
Yeah.
Riding Golden Tate and Anquan Boldin, by the way.
Got Marvin Jones involved in it yesterday too.
I'm sorry?
Got Marvin Jones involved in it yesterday too.
Yeah. Well, Marvin Jones was more than involved early on in this season. He was, you know, he was a go-to guy. He was, you know, kind of proving to be a number one caliber receiver the first couple of weeks. You know, yesterday, only 10 yards worth of catches, but he did get a touchdown, two catches for 10 yards, but it's Golden Tate. And then what a signing to bring in Anquan Boldin, not to replace Calvin in terms of doing the same things Calvin can do, but as far as veteran receiving presence, certainly bringing him and, you know, replacing him in that regard. Golden Tate, 8 catches, 165 and a touch. Anquan Boldin, 8 catches, 60 yards and a touch. And then spreading the ball around to Zenner, Roberts, Jones, Clay Harbor, and, you know, 23 completions, like I said, in 31 attempts. Matthew Stafford, a tremendous effort. And you mentioned the running game. Justin Forsett is here, meaning there, you know, in Detroit, but not obviously having a full grasp of the playbook yet, being fully implemented in. He carried the ball 5 times, only got 5 yards. Not a big deal, really. He's gonna find a way to work his way into that rotation as long as Abdullah's out. But in the meantime, Zach Zenner carried it 14 times for 58 yards, and that's 4.1 a pop. So, great job. By the way, real quick,
Bob, to take it a step further on Matthew Stafford overall for his, you know, for his season, that's, you know, it's a 3-3 Lions team and all the things you said. Just throwing this out there, he's 1,648 passing yards. I did the math, 68.8% completion. His overall rating for the season, 106, 14 touchdowns, 4 picks. I mean, I look at that line and I say, you know, you take away the name, I'd say, yeah, give me that quarterback for my team.
Well, I mean, the rating is the number you didn't give. 106.
106 for the whole season.
Yeah. I mean, if you take a look at the passer ratings, you know, and you'd say, who's on top in the league's passer ratings? Well, it's probably got to be Aaron Rodgers, right? It's going to one of the names we always hear. It's got to be Aaron Rodgers, or it's got to be Andrew Luck, or it's going to be Tom Brady. And you know what? Hey, here we sit. We're looking at Matthew Stafford with a quarterback rating of 106. That is an amazing statistic. Right now, if you just measure quarterbacks by that, only 2 guys are playing better. Matt Ryan, as I mentioned before, in Atlanta, who's had just a monster first half thus far, 2,000 yards, 15 touchdowns, 3 picks, 117.9 is quarterback rating. Sam Bradford, shocking everybody in far less attempts, by the way, but shocking everybody when he got picked up by Minnesota after Teddy Bridgewater went down. Sam Bradford has a 109.8 quarterback rating, but again, that's only in 125 passing attempts compared to 210 for Ryan and 212 for Stafford and over 200 for most of the other passers who are up high on this list. But then there he is at number 3, Matthew Stafford, 106.0, Phillip Rivers, 105.9, Dak Prescott, whom I mentioned, Drew Brees. Those are names you expect to see up there, you know, talking about Rivers and Brees and,
right,
and Ryan and those kinds of guys. How about Brian Hoyer, by the way, 7th right now? Brian Hoyer. Who has thrown 6 touchdowns and not a pick since taking over for Jay Cutler. He's got a 100.8. Those are the guys up over 100, the top 7 guys in the league. But to the point you were just saying, you know, league-wide, yeah, if you take Matthew Stafford's numbers and apply them to Rodgers or Brady, and nobody would blink. They'd say, yeah, those look like his numbers. Well, they're not. They're his numbers. They're Matthew Stafford's numbers. So congratulations to the Detroit Lions. And how about the defense, too, by the way? Holding Todd Gurley down,
yes,
58 yards. Case Keenum is nobody's, you know, All-American. But, well, then again, Case Keenum did his thing, too. Case Keenum, for a 3-3 Rams team that really looked like they were probably going to fire Jeff Fisher by week 5, they're 3-3. Case Keenum was 20. He had a better day than, you know, better day than Stafford did in completion percentage. 27 of 32, 321, 3 touchdowns. But he did have the pick. And despite the pick, the quarterback rating of 126.7. So he's really surprising a lot of people. Nonetheless, the Lions did what needed to be done to hold them off and win 31-28. Go ahead.
And that's the key, because what's been one of the other themes, whether we talk to Chris Lemieux or whoever on Lions stuff, that fourth, second half defense, fourth quarter specifically. Lions outscored them 17-7 in the second half, 10-7 in the fourth quarter, and the Lions scored the last 10 after the Rams went up very early, first minute of the fourth quarter, 28-21.
We talked about it last week and really the last couple of weeks. We have to figure out how to finish. You know, during that three-game losing streak, we have to figure out how to finish, and that's what they did yesterday. Okay, going to get a timeout here. Then we're going to shift gears, talk about the other NFL team that we cover, and that is the Cleveland Browns. We'll probably do that in a very, very limited capacity, because when we bring Dennis Manilow on, the first thing he's going to want to talk about is the other team out east of us in Cleveland, and that is the team that at 8:08 tonight goes for its sixth consecutive postseason victory, sixth straight against no defeats. They swept the Red Sox. Now they're up 2-0 against Toronto tonight, game three in the ALCS at 8:08, and we're going to talk to Manilow about that as we continue right here on ESPN 106.5.
France Extravaganza, ESPN 106.5, The Ticket.
That is indeed what it is. It is 3:40. Thanks for joining us right here on ESPN 106.5, The Ticket. We are Toledo's sports leader, but nobody is leading the way the Indians are leading right now, especially when they get a lead. Nobody is touching them, thanks to the magic man himself, Andrew Miller.
Up and down is the hard thing for relievers. We're just not typically trained for it, and you know, we have to prepare to pitch, you know, on a pretty regular basis. So I think the playoffs are a different atmosphere. I think you get to go out, and you know, these crowds are so incredible. You know, there's so much on the line. It's just a blast to be a part of it.
He is simply untouchable in the postseason, and we can only cross our fingers and hope that we get something remotely resembling untouchable tonight from game number three starter Trevor Bauer, who was described by second baseman Jason Kipnis this way.
If anybody's covered Bauer or talked to Bauer, it's kind of funny. He's a big, dumb animal. You need to babysit sometimes with his drones and his toys. And like I said, I don't care. As long as he can still pitch for us, you're an idiot, but let's go, go get some outs now.
A big, dumb animal that you have to babysit and an idiot. Hey, there's your game three starter tonight for the Indians against the Toronto Blue Jays in game number three of the American League Championship Series up at Rogers Center. Joining us now to talk about that and NFL football is our good friend Dennis Manilow, coming straight out of Cleveland, straight out of the CLE, right here in the TOL in the 419. What's up, D-Man? How you doing?
How good is Bob France and Kush?
Oh, man, we're having fun, brother. We are having all kinds of fun right now. We got a lot of great things happening around here. Nothing is as exciting to me, Dennis Manilow, than the prospect of being two games away from the first World Series for my favorite ball club in 19 years, since 1997. I cannot tell you how implausible all of this really feels.
Well, yeah, I mean, it is hard to believe it's been 19 years, like you say, because it just seems like the 90s teams, at least around here, were, you know, the other day. That's definitely a long stretch. And, you know, I'll say this, Bob, two games, that's a lot. I mean, there's going to be a lot of work to do for the Cleveland Indians to finish this series off, and I think they know it. And, you know, I mean, you've got people just because they're 2-0 thinking that they're going to automatically get in, but that's not the case. I mean, the Blue Jays are nasty, and they're especially nasty at home. I expect this to be a long series now. You know, and I wouldn't be surprised if the Blue Jays won all their games in Toronto and it came back here, and Cleveland won game six at the Prague, and we had a Donnybrook in game seven.
How are they doing this, Dennis? By this, I
have no idea.
Well, I mean, let's just you know, kind of break it down for a second. The most prolific scoring offense in baseball in the American League was the Boston Red Sox. Now you have the free-swinging, massively powerful, murderer's row kind of a lineup that you get from the Toronto Blue Jays. And the Indians are missing Carrasco and Salazar. And they're winning games through pitching. They've scored a grand total of three runs in the first two games of the ALCS and are up 2-0. How is this pitching staff missing two of its top three men in its rotation and this bullpen, and obviously we'll talk about Andrew Miller's greatness in a moment, but overall, how is this staff able to hold down these two tremendous offenses the way they have to the tune of 5-0 thus far in the postseason?
Yeah, Bob. I mean, regarding the Blue Jays, I mean, if you'd have told me before the series that in the first two games the Indians would combine for four runs, I have them for four. You had them for three. It's 2-1 or 2-0, 2-1.
Yeah, correct. Sorry games. About that.
But if you'd have told me four runs on 10 hits and three walks, that's the combined output of the Cleveland offense. I would have told you you're no better than 1-1, and you're probably 0-2. All right, because you can't realistically expect to hold down the Blue Jays. But instead, the Cleveland Indians in 18 innings of pitching, as opposed to the 16 innings of hitting, the 18 innings of pitching, they've allowed, as we say, one run there, and it was a double. It was an RBI double by Donaldson. So no home runs yet. It's been unbelievable, really. I mean, you had Kluber doing really well in game one, kind of expected there. Tomlin, unexpected game two. I'm sure the Blue Jays thought they were going to pound him with his finesse, but he was able to get through 5 2/3 with only one run allowed. And, of course, you have the Hammers at the back end, and I think that there is an intimidation factor now that's present with the Indians' bullpen that hasn't been there in my memory, Bob. I don't know if you can recall a time where the Indians' bullpen actually intimidated the opposition. We've seen it happen with other teams. We saw it with the Yankees this year with Betances, Miller, and Chapman. But I don't remember an Indians bullpen where the other team was actually in fear of it, and I think you have that now with the three-headed monster of led by Miller, and then Allen and Shaw, and I'm not listing those in order of, you know, 7th, 8th, 9th. I'm listing them in order of intimidation factor. You know, Miller's probably a 9-9 or a 10-1 on a scale of 1 to 10. Allen's about an 8 the way he's pitching, and then Shaw's right up there, too. And you could throw Disco Dan Otero in if you want as well and create a four-headed monster because Otero's been really good, even though he hasn't been used much in the postseason. But finally, the Indians have a situation where the other team has to worry about its bullpen, and I think that's paid off not only in this series but in the Boston series.
Yeah, and if you can draw a blueprint and follow it, this is exactly what you would draw. Get an early lead, have a start, be quality enough to get you through five, really, even, let alone six or seven, the way you're getting from Kluber and you're getting from Tomlin, and then just turn it over to that pen. Even, again, we saw this in the Boston series, going to Andrew Miller in the fifth if need be, but just that bullpen has been that lights out. Get the lead and get it through halfway through the game, and you are pretty much cruising home. You can't count on it, but that is exactly what the blueprint would be. Jim Cushland is here as well, D-Man. Jim, go ahead.
You know, I keep thinking about something, guys, and it's based on the whole rotation thing. I read something the other day that there's possible murmurs that they might bring a Kluber back for a game four, and the only situation, and this is really either of you, tell me if I'm crazy here, the only situation I could see them doing that, because game four, of course, is supposed to be Clevenger slash bullpen day tomorrow, is if, say, Bauer goes out there, he gets hit around, or that cut opens up, and he's bleeding all over the baseball, and the umpires force him from the game, essentially meaning they'd have to go to the bullpen day today. If something like that happens, would we possibly see a switch to maybe Kluber for a game four on short rest tomorrow?
Yeah, Kush, I wouldn't go with Kluber on short rest unless I wouldn't have gone with him unless you had lost the first two or you were in desperate straits in the series. I think that they're in control, obviously, at 2-0. I mean, it could evaporate in 2 days, but right now you're in control at 2-0. So I wouldn't do the short rest thing with Kluber, and even in the event of a Bauer meltdown tonight or finger whatever mishap, I still stick with Kluber on full rest, and I don't know what exactly they're going to do, but if anybody knows how to handle it, it would be Francona.
How would they handle a game four, though, if they are forced to use the bullpen with some length tonight?
They'll use different bullpen guys. I mean, to me, if Bauer gets lit up, I mean, if they go down, let's say 3-0 after one or 5-1 after two, and it's not looking good, to come back against Stroman, then they're probably going to use different guys than the Allen Miller Shaw group, and that would allow them to save that group for game four.
Yeah, and it's it's a real tough thing. Obviously, if they don't get good innings tonight from Trevor Bauer, and I mean long innings, at least through five, so that they can continue that same recipe that they had been using. Let's talk about that. What is your take on Trevor Bauer and this story? He said yesterday that he threw on Saturday. And they said there's very, very minimal bleeding, and that was just with 2 days since the injury, the drone thing on Thursday. So he says there's very little bleeding then. He said he's sure with 2 more days of rest and obviously healing that there will be no bleeding at all. And he said it certainly isn't affecting the way he grips the ball. He said he doesn't use his pinky with any of his pitches, even if it's curled into his hand, you know, when he's throwing certain types of pitches. You know, the stitches are on the outside, nothing that would touch the baseball to aggravate it. So he's kind of trying to sell everybody on this is no big deal. Please don't worry about this. This is not going to affect how I pitch tonight. You buy that?
Well, no, not really, Bob. I mean, all I would say to that is we'll find out, okay? A whole lot different when you're out there in front of that madhouse, you know, at Rogers Center, and the place is shaking, and you're out there gripping the ball, and you're probably putting more pressure on the ball than you normally do. That to me, every time I've thrown a baseball, the pinkies come in contact with the ball in some way, you know, and all it takes is a little aggravation, you know, to potentially open that up. So I'm totally in the wait and see mode on this rather than the, oh yeah, I guarantee there's not going to be any issues. I mean, they wouldn't have pushed him back in my mind if they didn't think there was somewhat of a concern that it would open up again. I don't know that you automatically heal something like that in a couple of days. So, I mean, you know, Bauer is, he's enigmatic. I mean, that's the classic way to, you know, describe him. I would
No. No, hold on. You say enigmatic. Jason Kipnis says big, dumb animal, an idiot.
Yeah. Well, look, I love Kipnis, all right? I love talking to the guy. He's fantastic with the media. He's a very bright guy. But I would disagree with Kipnis in this sense. I don't think that Bauer is anywhere near dumb, okay? And I think he was – I get where he was kind of hyperbolizing there, talking about a dumb man, big dumb animal.
Sure, sure.
Bauer's a very bright guy, and he's probably too bright for his own good in certain situations. You know, he's too scientific for his own good. You know, I'm not blaming, you know, if he pitches poorly or the finger explodes, I'm not going to say, oh, you know, that why did Bauer put the drone ahead of his team? I mean, I understand you got to be allowed to live, and that's his version of living. But I'm even talking about the way he pitches. You know, he overthinks a lot of things. He doesn't like to hear what other people say. He's got his own set ways of doing stuff. And why? Because he's put a lot of time into it. He studied it a lot. He kind of feels like he almost has a master's degree in pitching. He would probably say a PhD. So you're dealing with a very bright guy. It's not some, you know, absent-minded oaf who just shows up at the ballpark and stumbles out to the mound. But he is a fascinating guy, to say the least. And I'll be interested to see how he handles the inherent pressure of this game. And in that place, it's going to be as loud as he's ever heard any stadium, I'm sure, that he's pitched in. It's going to be fascinating to watch.
As great as the Indians pitching has been, we're talking to Dennis Mantloff previewing game number 3 of the American League Championship Series tonight, 8:08 first pitch. It's going to be up at the Rogers Center. As great as the Indians pitching has been starting and relieving, not just in this series, but really in the 5 postseason games overall, you can't say the same thing about the offense. They're getting the clutch hit from Lindor. They're getting the clutch home run from Santana. They're getting, you know, 2 or 3 guys, Lonnie Chisenhall, you know, are carrying them. But overall, the lineup has been held down by an almost equally proficient Toronto staff. So how do they fare tonight against Stroman?
Well, I think they're going to struggle. I mean, I have them losing this game. As I said, it wouldn't surprise me if they lost, or the Indians lost all 3 in Toronto. Just because I think Toronto plays so much better at home and they're more comfortable in their place and the crowd's going to be rocking and they'll feed off of that. And Stroman is a high energy guy who feeds off the crowd. So it wouldn't surprise me in the least if Toronto does an excellent job both offensively and pitching. The Indians, yes, I think they're living dangerously right now. They have to figure out ways to score more runs. I understand postseason generally speaking, runs are hard to come by, but, you know, they've got to score more. I mean, they can't just expect to win against the Blue Jays at 2 runs a clip. And as you pointed out, they need production from more than just a couple of guys. I mean, so far, I think 10 hits in the series, Chisenhall's got four, maybe, and Lindor's got three, and Santana's got the home run.
Right.
You know, three guys, I think eight hits, and both of the home runs. So they need more. Napoli's in a big rut. He's got to figure it out fast.
Ramirez,
too. Has got to get going. What's that?
I said Ramirez, too.
Yeah, Ramirez is, you know what? I'll tell you this, Bob, that's a guy. I haven't seen Ramirez swing like he is right now, probably all season, okay? He's taken some really bad hacks. I think he's pressing. He would never admit it, but he doesn't look like the same Jose Ramirez that I watched for 6 months this year. That's the one guy that sticks out. I mean, there's plenty of guys that aren't hitting. We get that. But Jose Ramirez is one of their best hitters, and he hasn't looked right, in my mind, the entire postseason.
Last thing, D-Man, we'll let you run it. We appreciate your thoughts on all of this as we look forward to game three tonight. Going back to what Kushlin asked you about before, about bullpen day tomorrow and about Corey Kluber. You've said already that if it was you, you would not go with Kluber until game five. But if they lose tonight and it's 2-1 and all of that momentum, especially if they have to use a lot of bullpen guys tonight, and all of that momentum that is built is on the line tomorrow, and if you lose two in a row at Rogers Center, now it's a different series altogether. And I know you still have the, you know, game six and seven at your place, but still, I feel like if they lose tonight, I almost have to win game four. I almost have to win game four. I almost got to go with Kluber there and then take my chances in game five up 3-1 as opposed to being, you know, deadlocked at 2-2. Am I just being too paranoid that a 2-2 series after being up 2-0 would just completely suck all of the, you know, the air out of the balloon and really give all the advantage to the Jays?
Well, I think you are a little bit, Bob, in this sense. Okay, do the Indians want to lose 3 in a row in Toronto? No, of course not. Do they want to win the series as fast as possible? Yes. But realistically, I think they have to sit there and go, you know what? Toronto is very good for a reason, and they're probably going to play really well at home. And if we don't match that, it's not the end of the world. That's why winning the first two was so critical, because now you can at least say, if we're down 3-2, and that would mean they've taken, you know, 3 in a row in Toronto, okay, at least the Indians could say, the series is still going. All we have to do, from the Indians' perspective, is win 2 games in our building. They can reduce it to that number. So, you know, I would rather see Kluber on full rest at his best to potentially steal one of the three in Toronto, then Kluber on short rest, not feeling quite as good. And remember, I don't even think he was 100% in either one of his postseason starts this year, even though he hasn't given up a run,
right?
Because of the quad.
Right.
I mean, I've noticed a guy who hasn't cut it loose, his velocity's not where it usually is, and I think part of it is he's a little tentative there with the legs. Which is totally understandable.
Tito said, if anything is affecting the velocity, it's his push off. You know, it's just not quite.
Well, yeah.
Either trusting the quad to hold up, or it's already sore when he pushes off.
Right. So you're already dealing with a guy who's probably not 100% physically, and then you want to run him out there on short rest. It doesn't make sense to me. And honestly, too, Bob, I'd rather play a little bit with the Blue Jays' minds on this whole bullpen day thing, because you know what? You send Clevenger out there and call it a bullpen day, even if you got, you know, roughed up in game three, you're saying to the Blue Jays, hey, you better beat us because we're doing Clevenger in a bullpen.
Right.
And maybe that puts pressure on the Blue Jays a little bit, and they squeeze the bat handle a little too hard. And next thing you know, they're in a tussle in the sixth or seventh inning, and they got to see the Indians' bullpen. So I don't agree with the need to have to run Kluber out there on short rest just because the Indians lost the game.
You make a valid argument. Like I said, mine is probably more paranoid than anything, because, you know, you're scientifically and analytically, I think you're certainly right on the money here with the rest. I would certainly be a lot more comfortable with it if we had Carrasco or Salazar, yeah, or somebody, you know, able, and of course, and you give him his full rest. You know, you don't bring him back on short rest, but, you know, it is where it is.
And
right
not
now.
Just that, guys, but if you do, if you keep Kluber on his normal rest, and let's just say that, you know, Bauer struggles and the bullpen day doesn't work. Well, it's 2-2, and you got Kluber on the mound to possibly, you know, hopefully do what he's been doing, steal one, and you're up 3-2 going back to Cleveland.
Correct. Correct. Yes. If you go Kluber full rest, you're in a 2-2 series. You're saying, I have Kluber for five, and I've got two home games potentially. So, yeah, I don't disagree with that if that's the decision they make.
Dennis Mandeloff joining us from Cleveland, where they will not be playing baseball tonight because that's because they're up in the Rogers Center. 808 first pitch, game number three. D-Man, thanks for the breakdown. We appreciate it. We didn't even bother to talk about the only winless team in the National Football League, mainly because, well, there's no reason to at this particular moment in time. D-Man, thanks for the thoughts, brother. We'll talk again soon.
How about those Lions, brother?
Yeah, we spent the last segment talking about those Lions, and they have given us a reason to talk here in Northwest Ohio. There's no doubt about that. Thank you, Dennis.
All right, man.
All right, there you go. Dennis Mandeloff joining us. Yeah, the Lions indeed winning two in a row. We just gave Matthew Stafford all of the praise and props that he certainly has earned. Okay, we're going to get a timeout here. We're going to get a top-of-the-hour Sports Center coming. Before we do that, though, I want to set you up with a possible flyaway to the College Football National Championship game. We've got a great opportunity for it. It's January 9th in Tampa, Florida. Trip for two to Tampa with round-trip airfare and a four-night hotel stay, two upper-level tickets to the game, rental car with parking, and a tour of the Yingling Brewery in Tampa. It all adds up to a $5,000 prize package if you are the grand prize winner. And we're going to qualify you for that contest right now. By the way, runner-up gets a pair of tickets to Ohio State and Michigan at the Horseshoe on November 26th with limo service. Third place, a prize package from Yingling. So if you want to be a part of that drawing, you can qualify right now by being the eighth caller to 2-866-240-1065, 866-240-1065. All brought to you by our good friends from Yingling Lager, Yark Chrysler Jeep Dodge Ram, Country Hearth Fireplaces and Stoves, Allegiant Air at Toledo Express Airport, Total Image Limousine, and of course, ESPN 106.5, the ticket. So the qualifier is yours if you are indeed the eighth caller. More coming up. Hour number two next, right here on the ticket.
Again, until we fix these things that we know that continue to bring us up short, we'll come up short. Our players are playing extremely hard. They give us a chance to be in games and win games. We just got to do it better.
There's another game where we fought really hard and came just a little bit short. Like I said before, they hurt really bad. And, you know, I want it so bad for these guys in the locker room. I'm giving them everything I have every time because I want it for them so bad, and they deserve it, as do the rest of the guys on the team.
Stafford takes the shotgun snap. Looking left, though. He's got the golden tape. Tate cuts it up 15. Tate outside 10. Tate to the 5. Tate to the end zone. Touchdown, Detroit Lions. Anquan Boldin with a big block to help spring him. And the Lions are an extra point away from tying this game. Keenum back. Throws over the middle. It is picked off by the Lions. Intercepted by Raphael Bush. Put this game away.
Guys made big plays in big moments. Did a nice job putting the ball in the end zone against a really talented group. You know, I don't think any situation is too tough for us. Seemed to rise to the occasion and play really well. It was a good, hard-fought football game. That's the NFL. Comes down to the fourth quarter more often than it doesn't. You know, you got to make the plays to win it. We were able to do that.
Snap to Barrett. Barrett throwing right corner of the end zone. And that ball's caught by Noah Brown for a score. Noah Brown with a touchdown in the right corner of the end zone as he got behind cornerback Derek Tindall. And the first TD pass of the night for the Buckeyes give them the lead here in overtime. Fourth and goal, Badgers of the Buckeye 4. Hornibrook in the shotgun, gets the snap, back to throw. Looking, the left-hander pumps, and he's going to be sacked and dropped right at about the 16. Nick Bosa, Sam Hubbard, and others with a game-ending sack in overtime, and Ohio State, who trailed this game by 10, comes from behind to defeat Wisconsin 30-23. 20 consecutive true road victories for the Buckeyes, who remain undefeated in a whale of a game here in Madison.
What pleases me is the brotherhood of trust. It's real. If it wasn't real, we would have lost. The indicators are up. The red flags are up. The team is good. We're playing. The environment, we'll take it and go.
Swung at, grounded towards short in the hole, backhanded by Lindor. Jump throw to first on one hop, and a stretch and a tag bait on the bag by Napoli with that back foot. And the kid Frankie Lindor is starting to show America what everybody in Cleveland already knows. There's not a better all-around shortstop in the game. Santana swinging, sends a liner deep left field. This ball is gone! He just did clear the 19-foot wall in left field. An absolute laser shot by Carlos Santana. Led the American League in steals, first time he's ever led the league. At age 35, no less. There he goes, pitches outside. Martin throw to second, no chance. Head first slide, and Davis made it easily. Way outside, off the glove of Martin. Davis going to third, throw to third. In with a feet first slide. There's that aggressive base running. Lindor, line drive, base hit to center field. And Nance back on top, 2-1. I wouldn't even have to call this pitch. The crowd will tell you. Here it comes. Guess what happened, folks? Back foot slider got him swinging. How about Andrew Miller? 5 strikeouts in 2 shutout innings of relief work. Swung on line to center field. Back goes Davis, turns one way, now the other. Makes the catch right in front of the track. Ball game. And the Indians have won again.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Onward we roll into hour number 2 right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. We are Toledo sports leader. We got a lot of good stuff already in the can, and we got a lot more to come here coming up this afternoon. Coming up at 4:30 or so, I should say. We're going to talk with Chris Lauterbach of 11warriors.com. That is an SB Nation website devoted to the Ohio State Buckeyes. And by the way, speaking of the Ohio State Buckeyes, they might be in the national championship game this year. And if they are, qualifier Doug Whitner of Perrysburg could be there to watch them down in Tampa. He was the latest qualifier. If you don't qualify on the program, you can qualify online at 1065theticket.com once per day. So good luck for that with that tremendous contest. By the way, Jim, you know who else might be there in that national championship game?
Who?
University of Michigan moved up to number 3.
Yeah, despite being on bye week.
Despite being on a bye week. Now, I will admit, this is one of those goofy things that I don't like. To be quite frank, I don't like those kinds of things. You know, I didn't play, and yet somehow I got better. That's just the goofiness of having these rankings, these subjective things, you know, that the writers and the quote-unquote coaches, yeah, usually the SIDs and everything else that they do. But be that as it may, I understand why the team in front of them went down. And that was number 3, Clemson,
yes,
who, of course, had moved back up into the top 3 after their tremendous performance against Louisville a week and a half ago, you know, beating Louisville, formerly undefeated Louisville, in Death Valley. But they got out. They, quite frankly, escaped with a win on Saturday. They were, what was it, a 38-yard field goal, I think? A 38-yard field goal away from losing to NC State.
Yeah, and that was the third one that kid missed on that day, apparently.
Exactly. They really, truly had no business winning that game, and I think everybody acknowledges that.
And that game was at Death Valley, too.
That's right. That's right. It would have been a home loss to a very, very under, you know, or I should say outmatched or outmanned team. You know, NC State really had no business being on the field with Clemson. And so Clemson really, to me, They look like I don't want to say a shell of what they were last year when they went to the championship, but I just feel like Clemson is not up to snuff, not up to par. Now maybe by the time November comes around, they will be, and they'll be just as dangerous as ever. And if they finish undefeated, they're going to go into the playoffs. I don't think there's any question about that. And if there is, you know, a tiebreaker kind of a thing, it might be just the fact that, hey, they were there last year, and so they kind of deserve another shot at it if there's a couple of undefeated teams to choose from. But I can understand why now, according to both polls, you know, you have the Michigan Wolverines who moved up. No, just one poll. Beg your pardon. That's just in the AP. Clemson holds a very slim lead over Michigan for the third spot in the coaches poll here in week number 8. So my apologies. It is Bama, Ohio State, Michigan. Interestingly, by the way, with Ohio State struggling a little bit, you know, to put away, and it took overtime, of course, at Camp Randall to put away Wisconsin, they received 0 first-place votes.
Notice
in the
that.
AP. Michigan, after their bye, still getting 1 first-place vote. Don't know who that's from. Might be from Michigan. From a writer from Michigan. Could very well be. I don't know. But I do know it's Alabama 60, and then Michigan is the only other first-place vote. Alabama almost unanimous after their just dominating win over Tennessee. And they were dominant over, to me, a team that I think was overranked
at number nine when they played on Saturday night. To me, I think Tennessee at 5-2 is still probably ranked too high at 18. After what App State almost did to them, at Tennessee, then guess what? To me, Alabama's win is a huge win, and the fact that it was 1 versus 9 is big, but it's not as big as maybe that would indicate, because I don't think Tennessee deserved that number nine ranking.
So no,
it's Bama. Let me run them down real quick.
Yeah,
Bama, Ohio State, Michigan, Clemson now 4. Washington remains at number 5. Texas A&M, Louisville, Nebraska. Those are all unchanged. No, that's not correct. Nebraska's up to 8 from 10, so they're up 2 spots from last week. Baylor is up 2 spots. They're up to number 9. And then Wisconsin dropped 2 spots. Obviously, everybody shifting there because of the Badgers' loss to Ohio State. So that's the AP top 25, or at least the top 10. And then for the coaches, it's Bama, Ohio State. Clemson does maintain that slim lead over Michigan. Then Washington, Texas A&M, Louisville, Baylor. A little bit of a change here. Baylor over Nebraska instead of vice versa with the AP. And then Nebraska, Wisconsin, again, rounding out the top 10. Go ahead, Jim.
And then, by the way, you're going to go through something. Don't forget, we around here, we'd like it to be Toledo, but there still is one undefeated team in the Mid-American Conference. So the MAC, by the way, still has a ranked team. That's Western Michigan, I believe. Yeah, Western, they're up to 20th right now. So that's always fun to keep an eye on.
Yeah, and you know what really bothers me is Toledo would be in the top 25 right now. That
no question.
Second field goal against BYU, the lone loss, the lone blemish on their schedule.
Oh, no question. They'd be 20, somewhere between 20 and 25 if they don't lose that game. I completely agree with that.
The gutsy call to go for 2 as well.
And they pulled it off.
And kick it to tie, with a minute 14 left. Wow. And they made it, to go up 52-51 in that game. I keep rehashing this from back on September 30th for the Rockets, but That was a gutsy call by Jason Candle. They made it. They're up 53-52. And then BYU comes down and kicks the game winner at the buzzer or at the final gun. That's just that's a rough way to have your only loss. They would be in the top 25 right now, no question about that. And by the way, perhaps fittingly, that is their season finale. The Rockets, who may go just, the undefeated the rest of the way as well. You could have a one-loss Rockets team in the season finale on November 25th against an undefeated Western team, if Western can hold on and do the same thing.
So yeah, for both teams, even though this team I'm about to mention is struggling to a small degree, anybody in the MAC West still has to get that monkey off their back, and that's beating Northern Illinois finally. Assuming both teams, Western and the Rockets, can do that, you're very much shaping up for a Black Friday showdown for the West title.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. And I think that's something that very likely will happen this year.
Northern is down.
Logan Woodside, the Rockets quarterback, is having just an absolute monster year. He leads the NCAA in touchdowns, passing touchdowns. Anybody, not just talking about the MAC or anything like that. He's leading all of college football in touchdown passes. That's an amazing thing when you think about it. He's got 24 touchdown passes in 6 games. Do you know that the Toledo's single season record is 29, set by, you probably know,
Gradkowski.
Bruce Gradkowski back in 2003 and then again in 2005.
Mm-hmm.
But Logan Woodside has 24 now through 6 games. He's averaging 4 a game. And that's why, like I said, he's adding himself to some quarterback lists, midseason quarterback award lists here, about halfway through the season. But Logan Woodside leading the nation again with 24 touchdown passes. Now, obviously, Lamar Jackson has touchdown passes and runs. He's got that market cornered. But he is just having an amazing season. And I really think this would be the year if they're going to get that Northern Illinois monkey off their back and can face Western in a kind of a winner-take-all showdown at the end of the season. That would be something. Of course, you still have the MAC championship game, but that would be something. Let me see. Woodside leads the nation with 24 TDs in 6 games. I'm just double-checking my stats here. Fifth in UT history right now for most TD passes in a season. That record I mentioned, 29 by Gradkowski. Woodside has thrown for at least 4 TDs in each of his last 5 games. So just a tremendous season thus far for those guys. Real quick, Jim, because we did not get a chance to talk about it. We are going to talk more Ohio State on college football coming up here after the bottom of the hour with Chris Lauderback from 11warriors.com. We talked a great deal about Matthew Stafford and the resurgent, if you will. I don't know. What do you call a team that lost 3 in a row and had everybody in Detroit and, of course, here in Northwest Ohio who are Lions fans calling for Jim Caldwell's head? And if you recall, it wasn't very long ago. It was, who deserves to be fired more, Ausmus or Caldwell?
Oh, yeah.
You know, is it resurgent or is it resilient? Are they just resilient and they're hanging on and they're not allowing their season to be flushed away, which would be resiliency? Or are they resurgent? Are they finding their footing now and saying, you know what, we're a pretty doggone good football team. We can beat these teams. They don't have a tough schedule. They don't.
That's
now, the Redskins, by the way, they are resurgent. The Redskins, who started out like garbage, the Redskins are on a streak right now. That's the, this week's opponent. Again, at home, a three-game homestand, if you will, for the Lions. You know, they just had Philadelphia, Los Angeles, and now Washington. Then they got to play a pair on the road. Houston, which took an unbelievable comeback, by the way, two touchdowns by Houston in the last 2:37, I think, is what it took for Houston to come back yesterday. Then Minnesota. Now, that's a challenge, certainly. But then you got to bye. And then Jacksonville, Minnesota again. That's twice in 3 weeks. New Orleans, whose defense is awful. They put up a ton of points, but their defense is awful. The Bears, who are just awful in all facets. They lost to Jacksonville yesterday, by the way. Then the Giants, who are kind of a 500-type caliber team. Dallas and Green Bay, tough to close the season, no doubt about that. So it's not an impossible schedule to look at the rest of the way for a 3-3 Lions team to say that this could potentially be a, let me see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Just playing with the schedule here, 6. I could see this being a 9-7, 10-6 team and in contention for one of the wild card spots.
Sure, and as of right now, I'm going to go resilient. And the reason I'm going resilient and not resurgent is I want to see what happens these next 2 weeks. You play against Washington, who, as you mentioned, is playing better right now, but they get that at home.
But very
beatable. Then the next week, the 30th, go on the road to Houston team. And despite what you just mentioned, that'll be a Houston team that will not be able to send J.J. Watt at you on the defensive side. So I will change my answer from resilient to resurgent if they take the next two and go into what will really be a tough game 3 weeks from now, November 6th, at Minnesota. I'll call them resurgent if they're 5-3 at that point. Otherwise, I'm sticking to resilient.
So right now they're just kind of hanging on. They're not letting that losing streak.
Perfect example was yesterday. They finally outscored somebody in the fourth quarter.
Yeah. And that is certainly a feather in their cap and maybe a sign that they are turning it around. By the way, a tremendous, as I mentioned, comeback. Two touchdowns in the final 2:37 yesterday by the Texans in their win over the Colts in that AFC South showdown. And then, of course, that forced overtime. The Texans won in overtime on a field goal. Brock Osweiler, quieting the critics at least for 1 week, 25-39, 269, and a couple of touchdowns. Lamar Miller finally doing what people waited for him to do when they signed him, 24 carries for 149 yards. For the Texans. I bring this up more to talk about the 2-4 Colts than to talk about the win by the Texans over them. What did I say to you at the beginning of this year? I said I am not sold on the Colts. A lot
you did
of people
say that.
Kind of feel like the Colts were certainly now that Andrew Luck had a full off season and being healthy, getting healthy, that they would be resurgent. Excuse me, I'm losing that voice again. It's rough.
While you're losing, I'll say I went with the Colts preseason in that division only on the grounds that, you know, It's a terrible division, and I felt that at the time he wasn't out for the year yet, but J.J. Watt was a little banged up, and I felt if he's going to miss time, Houston's got problems, so who's going to win that horrible division by default? Really, that was my thought of saying Colts winning that division preseason for me anyway.
Yeah, and I think that's fair. But like I said, to me, I think I picked the Texans to win it again only because of a lack of options. It's just a terrible division, and I'm not a believer in the Colts. And you know, this is going to be blasphemous to a lot of people, you know, and analysts and fantasy players around the country. But I'm not always sold on Andrew Luck. I'm saying. You know, I mean, I know what kind of a rookie season he had. I know what kind of potential he has. MVP caliber potential. But I just haven't seen a guy, and it's in part because he's being banged around so much, because he doesn't have a good offensive line, and he is taking a ton of sacks. But in part, I blame some of that on him. That is his style. He does hold the ball a little too long.
Yeah.
He isn't, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Andrew Luck, for all of his greatness and for all of his perceived top five QB in the game, you know, here in his fifth season, that's kind of how he's perceived. People start saying the names of Brady and Rodgers and Breeze and Luck and Roethlisberger and who else? I mean, I think that's the cream of the crop right about now. And then you get into the Philip Rivers and those kinds of guys. but for Tony Romo's before now, and now Dak Prescott's going to take his job because of injury, which is another story into it, all unto itself for sports talk. But he just kind of, you know, stakes his claim to that spot on a regular basis, and I think there's more to it than that. I don't think Andrew Luck has shown on a consistent enough basis in his 5 years that he can be or should be that guy. And here he is so far in this regular season. It's a solid season, 1,700 yards passing, completing 64%, 11 touchdowns, 4 interceptions. But you add 3 fumbles, now you got 7 turnovers responsible for, quarterback rating of 94. And for the sake of comparison, that's solid, but for the sake of comparison, what did we just say about Matthew Stafford?
Right.
106. That's a big difference. You know, and yesterday, kind of typical Andrew Luck. Big numbers. 28 out of 39. That was the Chicago. Where did yesterday's stats go? I think I just lost it. I'm looking at the wrong game now. Andrew Luck yesterday, 21 of 32, 252. So not as big of numbers. In a touchdown and a pick. That's more what I'm talking about. Now I'll go back to the other games I was pulling up for Andrew Luck. And again, you know, some big numbers in some games that, quite frankly, you know, they weren't good enough to win. Big numbers, but the big mistake mixed in. Just looking at last week against Chicago, 28 of 39, the numbers I started to throw out there, 322, 2 touchdowns and no interceptions. A solid game and a 29-23 win, but that followed 27 of 42 for 234. 2 TDs and a pick and a loss to the Jaguars. And that followed, let's see, a solid number, 24 of 37 against San Diego. 24 of 37, 331, 1 touchdown, 1 pick. Not stellar, 91, but solid enough to get the win. And then we go back to the first 2 losses of the year to the Lions, as we know, and the Denver Broncos. Very, very pedestrian in those games. So for me, even though he had 4 touchdowns and no picks against the Lions, they lost. And then against Denver, he was not good at all. 21 of 40, 197, a touchdown and a pick. Quarterback rating of 60. Or 64, should say, 64. So, to me, I'm not a big believer in the Colts because I'm not totally, completely sold on Andrew Luck. So, I'll just stick that out there and let that hang there. And all of that, of course, was a lot of divergence to take all of the attention away from the only winless team in football. That is the Cleveland Browns.
You did a good bang-up job of it.
Who continue to struggle, and, you know, they fight hard, and that's great, but they're just not fighting hard enough to win, and they just don't have the talent to win. Cody Kessler did some nice things yesterday. Terrell Pryor did his level best, had a couple of touchdown catches, but it's just not in the cards for this team to be anything more than a 2- or 3-win team, and I just think that's something we have to accept. All right, here's what else we have to do. We have to take a time out here. We're going to get a bottom-of-the-hour sports center, and I want to hook you up. Fright season is here, and I'm not talking about the Brown season. I'm talking about Halloween. This is more frightening. No, I take that back. The Brown season is more frightening. This is more fun. If you would like to go to the Haunted Hydro in Fremont, I've got boatloads of tickets. Do we still not have boatloads, Jim?
Yeah, that's a good way to describe it. We still got plenty.
Then let's give 2 pairs away to callers 10 and 11 right now. If you want to go to the Haunted Hydro, I'll give you each a pair, a pair to caller 10 and a pair to caller 11 at 866-240-1065 right now. We'll send you to the Haunted Hydro so you can have a little bit of fun this October, especially when it's warm out like it is. It's really a great time to be out at the haunted attraction, so have fun with that. On the other side, we're going to shift gears and go from the NFL to college football once again on our Monday afternoon quarterback and break down the Buckeyes' overtime win over the Wisconsin Badgers in a 2-versus-8 top-10 matchup at Camp Randall. We're going to talk to Chris Lauterbach from 11warriors.com. That's a Buckeye site on SB Nation as we continue right here on The Ticket.
Once again, it's the Bob France Extravaganza, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
What pleases me is the brotherhood of trust. It's real. If it wasn't real, we would have lost. The indicators are up. The red flags are up. The team is good. We're playing. The environment, we'll take it and go.
Team is damn good that they were playing, and that's what makes an overtime win at Camp Randall in prime time, a night game. against the number 8 ranked team in the country and one of the best defenses in the country. Nothing to be embarrassed about. Nothing to be wondering what's going on with the Buckeyes. Why did they need OT? That was a doggone good opponent that gave the Buckeyes everything they wanted and more. But to say that they rose to the occasion is an understatement, because JT Barrett is named the co-Big Ten Offensive Player of the Week this week for a performance that included 318 total yards and, of course, that game-winning touchdown pass in overtime. Joining us now to break it down, talk college football with us on our Monday afternoon quarterback edition of the Extravaganza, Chris Lauterbach from 11warriors.com. That is a Buckeye fan site for SB Nation. Hey, Chris, how are you, sir?
I'm doing well. How about you guys?
Fantastic. Feeling great. A lot of good stuff going on. We got playoff baseball going on. One of the two teams that we cover the closest around here is in the American League Championship Series, and the Ohio State Buckeyes continue to roll along despite, I think, what we would all agree was one heck of a heavyweight battle, Big Ten style, on Saturday night at Camp Randall. That Wisconsin defense is every bit as legit as we were kind of told they were, and we kind of thought they were going in.
Oh, yeah, no question about it. I think, definitely expected a physical game in a hostile environment, and that's every bit of what they got. Obviously, the bye week as well is something that Wisconsin's coaching staff, to their credit, took full advantage of. And, you heard Urban Meyer talk about it, throw some things at Ohio State that they didn't really expect. Obviously, just defensively, the way they stacked the box and really kind of dared, Ohio State to beat them through the air was definitely something that Ohio State struggled with for a half. And then finally, kind of found some footing there in the second half.
Yeah, no question about it. They really did. And let's talk about JT Barrett, who was 17 of 29 for 226 with that one touchdown. Also threw a pick, but he also carried it 21 times for 92 yards and had two rushing touchdowns. So he accounted for three, which, by the way, breaks Braxton Miller's record for touchdowns responsible for in a singles in a career, I should say. So tremendous accomplishment there by JT Barrett. But this is a guy who I don't want to see was maligned, because he's still considered to be a Heisman candidate, along with a whole bunch of other people. But was, questioned a little bit maybe for not being as sharp as he had been in the win over Indiana the week before. He just wasn't as sharp as he had been earlier in the season. So for JT Barrett, and again, I don't know that he was at his very, very best in terms of pinpoint accuracy, but he found ways to account, as we pointed out, for 318 yards and to lead this team into the end zone, as often as he needed to.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that he was necessarily at his best, but I also sometimes struggle with what they expect from this kid. I don't think, as great as he's been, I don't think he's ever been a pinpoint passer that I'm aware of down the field. His completion percentage, people should remember, is a school record right now for his career. I think around 64, 65, something like that. But it's currently, he already holds the school record for career completion percentage. I think some of that is the function of the offense, where typically, they're going to be a little bit shorter routes and things like that. And he has struggled with the deep ball at times. But I really feel like this year, he's definitely, he's missed on some throws here and there. But I feel like the receiving corps is every bit as accountable as JT Barrett for any, question marks down the field. I mean, there's times where receivers have gotten past their, gotten past their defender on a deep ball and it's been underthrown, no question about it. But what I see more on those, intermediate plus routes is that sometimes these wide receivers fail to gain separation, and throw in the fact that he's not had a lot of game reps with these guys, that, it's probably fair that sometimes he's waiting for the guy to be open versus trusting that he's going to be open or throwing him open just for maybe lack of reps, game reps, with this particular receiving core.
We're talking to Chris Lauterbach of 11warriors.com, an SB Nation fan site devoted to all things Buckeyes, right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. Let's talk about a couple of other things in that game. And in fact, it's a story on your site right now, posted by Eric Seeger, so one of your colleagues, talking about the sideline interference penalty that Ohio State endured during that win over Wisconsin. Urban Meyer, to say he was upset is an understatement. Just change the damn rule is what he essentially is saying. What are your thoughts on what happened?
First I'd be remiss if I didn't say 11warriors.com, we are an indie site. We're not affiliated with any particular conglomerate such as SB Nation or another.
Apologies.
So.
I had.
Oh, no, no.
I'm so sorry. I thought it said SB Nation on my Cliffs notes here.
As far as the
site. We talked to a lot of good folks from SB Nation site, so thank you for
that. Absolutely. We love those guys as well, but no, we're indie and pretty proud that we're an independent, able to function as an independent site. But getting
awesome.
To the point
you.
Of the sideline warning, obviously, I mean, come on. It's a rule, and Urban broke the rule, and he was flagged for it. But, you know, whether or not he had one foot on the white, I think he did acknowledge that today. To me, the bigger issue is two things. One, as Urban mentioned, why that's a 15-yard penalty seems a bit excessive. And then, you know, just two, that's the third time this year this has become an issue, whether it was a warning first and then a penalty or not. But if memory serves, I believe it happened against Tulsa. I think it was Tulsa. I know it happened against Indiana, and then it happened again this week. And it wasn't Urban Meyer the other two times. I know a referee ran over an assistant coach, I think it was in the Indiana game, that was, you know, clearly in the white where they shouldn't have been. So I don't know if Ohio State needs a new get-back coach or what they need to do. But until the rule changes, that's a 15-yard penalty, and you just can't have that happen whether you like the rule or not. That could have been a much bigger factor.
I don't disagree with that at all, Chris, but I do agree with Urban. And that is, you know, and he said, that broke my heart to put your players in a 15-yard penalty for that in a big game. He said, some will say, well, that's the rule. I'm saying get rid of the damn rule. It's not a good rule.
Yeah.
And I agree with him. I really do.
Yeah, well, I do as well. And I think in the future that's something they could look at. Like I said, you know, they're trying to make sure the referee can stay upright while they're doing their job on the sideline. And, you know, I'm not a fan of a referee more than the next guy. But if they wanted to keep the rule 5 yards or something like that seems appropriate. If they want to get rid of it, that certainly makes sense, too. I'm just saying that until they do get rid of it, I think Ohio State needs to be, you know, a little bit more methodical in how they make sure that's not an issue going forward, considering it's happened 3 times in 6 games.
We're talking to Chris Lauterbach of 11warriors.com. Let's send some more people to your website to look for this story written by another of your colleagues, Tim Shoemaker, about the decision to play for overtime and why. Because the Ohio State red zone defense is so good. And obviously you didn't write this one, but let's talk about that because that is something I think everybody knows. If you get an opportunity to play for overtime and you're Ohio State and you have that kind of a defense, it just does make sense. They do not give up points. It seems like whenever they do give up points, there's a big play, there's a breakdown, that sort of thing. And they don't give up many, obviously, if you look at their record. But when you have limited space, which, of course, is the difficulty of scoring in the red zone, Ohio State's defense is smothering.
Yeah, well, yeah, I don't think there's any question about it. It was the right call. I think, you know, throwing in the fact that if they were on the road in a hostile environment is another reason where you're probably not going to try to, you know, gamble offensively there. Every fan in that situation, or most fans, are, you know, like, oh, we should have tried to throw deep or whatever. But, yeah, I think at that point you want to look at it and say, okay, in a 25 yards and in situation, do I like my defense, you know, in that situation? And clearly the answer was yes, and clearly it worked out, especially when you think about how the defense was playing in the second half. I mean, in the first half, there were definitely some issues with the defensive effectiveness, and I think that got cleaned up with some adjustments, you know, by the staff at halftime, so that, you know, in the second half, it was a whole different effectiveness level from Wisconsin's offense, and that even furthered, you know, that it was the right decision to go to overtime in that case.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, looking back at it, of course, with hindsight, it is certainly the right decision, but it's also the right, I think, you know, decision ahead of time. Again, looking at the stats, Ohio State, and again, this is quoting from your site, Ohio State is number one in the country in red zone defense now through 6 games. They have allowed opponents inside the 20 16 times and have given up points on just 10 of those occasions, 10 of those trips. That's 62.5%, which is number one in the country, and only 4 of those 10 times were they touchdowns. So, you know, clearly this is something that Ohio State has confidence in, that they can shut teams down, obviously, when they get closer to the goal line. And that is going to be, you know, play such a big role when they get matched up against higher scoring teams. You know, Nick, no disrespect to Wisconsin, but, you know, you do have a freshman quarterback who, by the way, is going to be a really, really good one. But defense is the strength of Wisconsin. When you get against some of the better offensive teams in the Big Ten to come, not the least of which, of course, is Michigan, that red zone defense is going to play a huge factor.
Yeah, and I think it was a huge factor at the end of the first half as well. I mean, Ohio State's defense held Wisconsin to 2 field goals in the last 3 minutes of the first half. That was gigantic. I mean, Ohio State was down 10 points 2 different times in the game. And if either one of those would have been touchdowns, that puts that much pressure on, you know, potentially a passing game at that point because you're playing from a little bit further behind. So couldn't agree with you more on Ohio State's red zone defense and how that could, you know, really be a linchpin as the season continues to unfold.
looking at the rankings and just kind of watching that closely, Chris, any thoughts on the fact that Michigan has been bumped up during a bye week to number three, at least in the AP poll? And that's not, of course, because they did anything. It's because Clemson had barely escaped. And, of course, they were number three, barely escaped against NC State at home on a couple of missed field goals, including one as time expired before overtime there. So that's a really, really interesting development that you have Ohio State 2 and Michigan 3, even though we still have several weeks left.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it'll play itself out, and maybe that doesn't mean a whole lot, you know, right now that they flip-flopped, but I personally completely agree with that. Clemson's kind of been teetering all year and really living off the fact of, you know, how they entered the season as far as the preseason rankings, and they haven't lost, so they're certainly not going to fall too far, but they have not looked that great. I mean, the Louisville game was a heck of a game, obviously, but I feel like either team, you know, could have won that one. And, you know, that was at Clemson, so they, you got to give them the nod there anyway and expect that they'll win. But that NC State game, I don't know if you saw the field goal that NC State missed to win it, but I mean, that was straight 30-some yards.
38, I think, yeah. 38, yeah. Very easily makeable by most high school kickers.
Yeah, well, you know, and in the era of college kickers, I mean, you know, anything is possible. That's not a gimme, but I mean, that was a straight-on kick that they missed. And, you know, Clemson's had a couple other, if not, you know, maybe not close calls, but they just haven't looked that dominant, where Michigan has, whether, you know, Ohio State fans want to like it or admit it or not. They've looked damn good every time I've watched them. So I don't have any problem with that flip-flop at all. And, I mean, like I said, at the end of the day, it won't matter because, you know, it'll play itself out, and both of those teams have a chance to still be in the Final Four when the smoke clears.
As you look at the rankings right now, and not just the rankings, but the actual landscape of this whole thing, we're talking to Chris Lauterbach, by the way, from 11warriors.com, which is a Buckeye site, tremendous Buckeye site. Check it out at 11warriors.com. But as you look at the rankings, excuse me, right now, and the number of undefeated teams, if you had to kind of just project, you said it yourself, it's going to play itself out, of the undefeated teams in the top 10, which would bring us Bama, Ohio State, Michigan, Clemson, Washington, Texas A&M, Nebraska, and Baylor. And then there's West Virginia down there at 12, Boise State 6-0 down there at 14. So let's just focus on the top 10 for now. Which of these teams do you think are the most likely to finish, or how many of them do you think are most likely to finish undefeated, taking into account some of them play one another, of course?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I haven't looked at the future schedules that far out in advance, but when I just think about the best teams, I think Alabama probably has the best chance. Especially because I'm not as bullish on the SEC as some are. I really don't feel like the conference is all that strong this year. And from what I've seen of Bama, to me, they're the clear number one. And then it's a bunch, you know, a bunched amount of teams kind of behind them. So I would say Bama has the best chance. Certainly give Ohio State a chance, but, you know, they've definitely have a tougher schedule than Alabama from my perspective. After that, I don't know. I kind of want to go out on maybe, I don't know about a limb, but maybe say Washington. I think they've looked really good so far, and the Pac-12 overall, or 16 or whatever they call themselves, isn't all that
they,
great.
They only have one ranked team left on their schedule, and that's number 19, Utah. They got Oregon State.
Yeah, there
they
you
were
go.
First on my list. They got,
yeah,
they got Oregon
go.
State, so, Utah, Cal, USC, ASU, that's Arizona State, and Wazoo. So, to me, I think Washington has a very, very good chance of making the playoff by being undefeated.
Yeah, I definitely would give them a better shot to do it than Clemson at this point. And obviously, I can't say Michigan because I do think Ohio State wins that game.
Yeah, agreed. And just looking at some of the other ones, you know, A&M, they've got Alabama, so forget about that. That's not going to happen again. And I guess I'm just trying to project out. I agreed with what you said about Clemson kind of sitting where they are now because of where they started, which is, again, and I hate to keep beating the same dead horse to all my listeners, but I cannot stand the preseason rankings. If they just ranked these teams for the first time, say, on the 1st of October, I don't think Clemson would be number 3 or number 4 overall. I think he'd be down around 9 or 10 or 11 or somewhere in that neighborhood based on performance. And that's why those things to me are troublesome, because the committee that puts the playoffs together, they look at these rankings and they do take them into account. So that's just my soapbox that I always get on. Great work, as always, Chris Lauterbach. You and your colleagues there at 11warriors.com, we really enjoy it. Thanks so much for coming on with us. We appreciate the time.
Absolutely. Have a great day.
You do the same. Thank you so much. All right, the music is playing. It got to here a lot faster than I thought. That's a great conversation. Keep talking Buckeyes with a guy like Chris all day long. But for now, you're going to have to talk with Mr. Mike Miller. You got drive time coming your way, and that's not all day long, but it's an hour long. Stay right here. We've got football for you tonight as well. Coming up tomorrow, 3 o'clock, back at you again for the next extravaganza. Have yourself a great night. Bye-bye.